Okay, my name's Tom. I work for the Linux Systems in Tokyo, in Japan. I load balancing software most of the time, or high availability software. Sometimes I write in operating system live in Japan. I really like this. Anyway. Okay, so very quickly, I'm going to talk about this. Talk has two halves, and I'm going to be running a bit low on time, so if you could hold questions for the end. First half, I'm going to be talking about doing connection synchronization. The second half, I'm going to be talking about active-active. They both relate to layer four switching, so I'm going to very quickly talk about that first. In the Linux kernel, we have a layer four switching implementation called LBS. As of 2.4.22, it went into the mainstream kernel. It's also in the 2.6.3. Layer four switching allows you to load balance network-based services. So this basically works by you have a virtual server set up on your router or your load balancer called a Linux director. When the first packet comes in for connection, it decides which is the real servers, the actual back-end machine it's going to use, forwards the packet through, and forwards all the subsequent packets for that connection. It's pretty straightforward, it's very effective, works on pretty much any protocol, and because it works fairly low in the protocol stack, it can make it very fast. LVS has always been very fast. We can easily saturate 100 meg Ethernet. It's now very, very old hardware. We can go up to 3 gigabit a bit more CPU. In fact, it turns out it really ends up being a PCIe bus problem more than anything else. There's a problem with this. Fundamental problem is you've got one machine in the front of the network. If that dies, everything dies. So you got a bunch of end users hanging out over here, talking to all of these machines over here. If one of these dies, it's not so good. Some of your users are going to drop their connection. If this dies, everything goes away. That's it, the network server. So to get around this, people usually may have two, have an active standby setup. That's pretty easy to achieve. Have one, you just find the virtual IP address here. If that you have some software running, it'll monitor this machine. If it fails, IP address change over, it goes over here. You can also use VRRP-V2, which is similar technology. That's a solved problem, that's pretty straightforward. Well, the problem is that this is where my talk comes in. First problem is, if you've got load balance the Linux director running, and someone's doing a really long download, maybe streaming some media, which could go for days, and you switch over to the other load balance, it doesn't know anything about that connection, so the connection's going to break. HTTP connections, which is what this technology is usually used for, are usually fairly short-lived, so it's not been an absolutely critical problem, but obviously something you want to fix. And the other problem, which is more a theoretical problem because they do go very fast, is you can only scale. You can scale the real servers as much as you want, but the Linux director, it's just one machine. So however fast that can go, that's how fast your network can go. For most people, that's not a problem, but on a more theoretical standpoint, it is a problem. So we developed some technology to allow you to have two Linux directories running at the same time. And it turns out you can use that as a way, you can eliminate the Linux directories altogether and use this active-active mechanism just as the way of load balancing by itself. Connection synchronization. How does it work at the moment? And I should say that I did this work a little while ago, and the LVS synchronization code, which is in the kernel, has improved since then. So a lot of the improvements that I made were also made elsewhere. Anyway, the way it works is when a connection comes in, you've got a load balancer for the duration of connection. Creates an IPvS con structure. This is pretty simple little structure. It has little bits of information like what's the source IP address and port, what's the virtual IP address and port, and where are we actually sending, what's the real IP address and port, and a bit of overwriting in there too. This is a key structure. That's what's used when all the subsequent packets come in to identify a new connection. So if we can synchronize that little structure, then basically we can solve this problem of dropping the connection if a failure occurs. So in the IPvS con thing is also used to map, but that's not really very important. So and well, sort of also important to note is persistence is also implemented using this IPvS con structure. Persistence means I make a connection to the virtual service and I get to real server A. Then I make a subsequent connection, and for some reason, because the way that ASP has been written really badly or something like this, I really want to get back to the same real server. Persistence is this idea that a given client will end up on the same machine within a given space of time. And that's also implemented using the IPvS con structure. So if we can synchronize them, not only can we keep the connection going, we can also keep the persistence going year for years. We can also keep the map going. And so it's really just the key to the problem. Of course, if you don't have the structure, it's not very convenient. So the current synchronization code is, when I say current, what I mean is what's in the obvious official tree as opposed to the stuff that I've written, which is a little bit different. It just counts the packets coming by from the connection. Once it exceeds 3, i.e. TCP handshake, then it puts it just throws it into the connection, the synchronization, and then puts it on the queue. Every now and again, the daemon wakes up, and by every now and again, I mean like every second, every half a second, wakes up, sees what's in the queue, and sends that out over the network using multicast, which a client daemon is sitting on the other end listening to. It picks them up, shoves them into the kernel. It's all good. What's the problem? Well, the problem, for some reason that is well beyond my reasoning ability, when they designed this, they made it a master-slave situation. You have a master server, which is sending out information. You have slave servers that receive the information, and it can't be the same thing. And it's like, well, what happens when failure occurs and the master becomes a slave? Oh, well, you can restart the daemons, or you can do some other crap like this, and it's just stupid. So it's a pretty obvious problem. You've got a connection going to Linux Director A. It's all wonderful. It dies. Oh, it's being synchronized over here, so B knows about it too. Beautiful. Okay. Linux Director A, B fails for some reason. Connection keeps going to Linux Director B. Wonderful. No connection synchronization going on at all because it's a slave. A comes back online, flips back again, becomes a master again. Connection keeps going through here. Oh no, sorry. New connection comes through here. So A knows, B knows all about it, but it's not synchronizing it back to A. B fails. What happens to the connection? Thank you, friends. It's just ridiculous. I mean, it's just a silly design. So how can we fix this? Well, it has been fixed, actually. So they added some patches to basically allow you to have the client and slave running at the same time on the same machine. I still don't understand why it has to be two separate things. But, and that's in the 2.6 kernel. It's not in the 2.4 kernel. If you hunt around on the Linux look through my code in the mailing list, you'll find that it works. I didn't write the patch, I fixed it, it didn't work. But I decided to take a whole new approach to this, which is to basically study centralization information into user space. In user space, we can do all sorts of funky things with things with relatively little effort. And like, so like, when you put a bug in your code and that crashes, it just crashes the process, not the whole machine. And you can put stuff, like all sorts of funky stuff you might want to do, you can do it in user space, which is a lot faster than kernel space. And it's not a performance critical problem. So we address the peer-to-peer problem, that's pretty easy. We put it in user space so it can be a bit more complex if we want to. We address a few minor problems to the protocol and make the synchronization code in the kernel modular, so you can just register other mechanisms. So the protocol is really simple, 4-byte header, bunch of graph underneath, maximum 1200 bytes. Synchronize once it gets to 3 packets, you can configure that, and then it synchronizes it with 50 packets, but you can't configure that. So, make the obvious steps, add a checksum so you can detect errors, add a version number so you can change the protocol without everything falling to bits. Allow the max and packet size to be changed. That's not really that important. 1200 bytes, 1500 bytes, isn't it? Yeah, whatever. I found that when I was using user space, it was more efficient to use much larger packets. And allow the frequency to be adjusted. That seemed pretty obvious to me. So here's the architecture of what we're going to do. We've got the LVS core down here, and then we've got the LVS sync master. That's kind of like the existing synchronization daemon. We're just going to make a new version of that. And then we're going to basically make this, instead of being a daemon, it's just going to be a bunch of hooks, and they're going to be implemented by this module here, the VBS user sync module. And then it's going to send stuff down up to user space, and down to user space, depending on which way you look at it, using network link socket, a little bit of a library to make that easier. And then I've got a rep sample implementation of how you can use this. So, and one thing I will say, which I won't tell my clients to pay me to write this, is it didn't really take very long to do this. And, I sort of went to Japan to do some work, and after a few weeks I kind of finished it, so it was really cool because I got to see the rest of Japan. But even after that, very small, really quite small, the hard part was getting this kernel code to be cracked. But after that, this thing was really easy. Really easy. Okay, so we use NetLink socket. Anyone who knows anything about NetLink socket, so it's really, really fast, so that's good. We'll talk about user space again. I think we've got all about that. We got the possible disadvantage of performance. Well, we're only really transmitting metadata. We're not synchronizing the connection itself, just metadata about the connection. So even for a fully flooded Ethernet connection, 100 megabit Ethernet connection, we're only talking about very small amounts of data being used. Also, NetLink socket is extremely fast. We're talking gigabits or tens of gigabits a second. In fact, they're even kind of rapidly. This is the speed I was getting. This is, sorry for the low quality, I forgot to save it in a vector format. So we've got 800 kilobytes, so that would be like about a gigabyte or something. And we see for some of obscure reason there's a peak around 4K. 6K packets, so that's how big I can handle. Anyway, as you can see, this is very fast. It's especially when you're transferring to a small amount of information. So performance really is not a problem. So move right along. This is the API that I defined for the hooks. So it's pretty obvious. Send, open, close. We've got the event loop, which is for the master who's sitting in there waiting for stuff to arrive. And then close, open, close. So using these hooks, I was able to implement the new code that I wanted to write, and I was also able to re-implement the old code. So even after I've patched it, and I have these hooks, the existing behavior works exactly the same as it did in the first place. So this was all very nice, so I was very pleased with that. And then I have two functions to allow you to register the hooks. Register, and there's not an unregistered code, it's external, you always want something to be happening. So I just register the default things back to the existing behavior. Register the default could just pass in that function with null hooks, and that would also that would work because it wouldn't do nothing. Because as it mentions, if they use null, they're just not used. Okay, I kind of made a little bit of a mistake in my design here, but it's not really that important. It's when my module gets inserted, it starts off with doing and then it goes. It would have been better if you insert the module and then you have a user space utility to start and stop the module. That would have been more in keeping with the existing behavior, but it's not a big deal and it's easily fixed. And it didn't really occur to me until I was writing this talk. Alright, so this is the kernel module that does the stuff. I'm not interested in writing code in this presentation, so I think that's really important. So. It does what the existing module does. It receives these little constructs from LDS core as it's running, and then bundles them up in a cube, and then when it gets to a certain size, pushes it out to user space. And vice versa, when it receives stuff from user space, it breaks it apart and sends it back into the kernel. And I wrote a little library to make it a little bit easier to work with this stuff. Send, receive, and also define the packet format. The packet format here actually encapsulates the existing synchronization in the packet format. The reason being is there's all this licensing problems, and I didn't want to have to manipulate the data inside the packet. And in fact, this synchronization, the daemon knows nothing about what's inside. Now, I mentioned you could make one that's smarter, and if it were smarter, you might want to do that, but it would have to be GPL code because it's the stuff of the kernel. Data structures that have been defined in the kernel. Anyway, so my code doesn't care about that, it has this little wrapper. Data structure that goes around it. And then the simple sync code, which is just like this really simple beam and it just listens on the net link socket when something in comes in, does some minor twiddling of it, and then sends it out as a multicast and vice versa. So obviously that's a very simple piece of code, but you have the potential to do things like add security, so you've got signing the packets, or whatever it is you want to do to it, the synchronization, monitor it, order it, I don't know. And just on security, like this doesn't implement security, but obviously if you're basically sending data across the network, that's going to be injected into the kernel. It would be nice if you knew where it came from. And it's running on multicast UDP, so spoofing is possible. Okay, that's the first half of my talk, and ripping right through, this is great. Okay. So active-active is a completely different problem. The idea here is you've got multiple machines, and you want them to be doing the same, handling the same, not the same connections, but handling the same IP address at the same time. So you know you want to basically load balance the load balances. And It's all a bit theoretical because really LVS is very fast, but it's what the customer wanted, so I made it. So we do this with playing with MAC addresses, which is a pretty obvious approach and also a pretty nasty approach. It's designed to be used with the Linux directories, but you can use it for other things. Pretty obvious application is DNS. Because DNS is like, you know, one packet goes in, one packet comes out. You don't have a whole lot of state going on. So this sort of system would work really well with that, because you're not worried about what happens if the machine crashes halfway through the connection. Okay, so we all know what MAC addresses are. They used by Ethernet to address other Ethernet cards, a little bit like the way IP addresses are used to address different hosts. ARP used to resolve a MAC address, and this is the way it usually works. ARP request goes out, one or zero responses comes back, depending on whether the machine's there or not. And it stays in the cage for a while, because you don't want to be spending half hour for every single packet you want to see. MAC addresses are assigned, groups of MAC addresses are assigned to manufacturers. So manufacturers have their own unique range, and usually they manage to send the cards out, so each one has a different MAC address. So I heard a very interesting story recently about unconfirmed, but SGI sending out a bunch of cards with the same MAC address, and firmware that didn't allow you to change the MAC address. It's bad. So anyway, most cards you can change. So the point of this slide is, usually on a network, each machine has one MAC address. One MAC address is only present on one machine. If it's not like that, things usually break in really weird ways, but it almost always is. Okay, most Ethernet cards allow you to change the MAC address. This is a feature that's not often used because it's not that useful. But this means, of course, that you could make all the machines have the same MAC address. And what would this mean? This would mean in the Ethernet, down at layer 2 in the Ethernet, down the bottom, it would all go to the same, that all the NICs that have this MAC address would get the packets, every packet that was sent to that MAC address. As an example, I'm showing how ARP would work. The same for any packet. This is not the same as promiscuous mode. Promiscuous mode means that the NIC is accepting all traffic and then the kernel actually accepts or rejects packets here. It's all still down in hardware on the NIC. Okay, but of course there's a problem. Problem is that switches, which you usually see about here, are a bit smart. And so what switches try to do is they try to associate a MAC address with a port, so they only have to send traffic to that port. And that's good because it means the other ports actually can be doing other things. So you can have 100 megabit network, but basically every machine gets 100 megabit instead of being shared. Okay, that's cool. But if you got multiple machines with the same MAC address, of course, really only one of them is going to get it, and that's not what we want. We want all of them to get it, and so this is not good. So I was talking last night about some new ways of solving this problem, but this is the one I came up with. The switch only knows which MAC address is associated with the port by observation. It doesn't know beforehand. You don't program the switch. Just observes the network, sees a packet being sent from a MAC address, and it's like, okay, well, that MAC address belongs there. And people don't move their machines around on the network very much, so that works pretty well. But here's the thing, if you never send a packet with that MAC address, it can't know where it is because it never sees it. So what you do is you use a different MAC address to send packets as to receive packets. No, really. There's lots of... I didn't say it was a good idea, but it still works. this obviously has a lot of problems. Basically what we're doing is we're turning a switch back into a hub for a particular set of hosts. Implementation turned out to be really, really, really easy. Basically you got what's it called, east.c in the kernel. You just modify about 3 lines of that. Add a new proc entry, which is about a number of 50 lines, and off you go. So we have basically IP proc entry, where, of course, after you patch the kernel, the default behavior is to behave in the normal manner that everyone expects, is where one gets one MAC address. And you basically twiddle the proc entry, you put in the MAC address you want it to use, and off you go. Now, the actual hardware address of the NIC is still used for receiving packets, and this is still not the same as Premier Express mode. So the kernel is not not having to be concerned with throwing away the packets. It only kind of receives the packets for that NIC. All the kernel does, which is a bit weird, is when it's just about to send the packet out to the wire, it changes the NIC to this this dumping NIC that you've made. And it doesn't have to be a completely arbitrary NIC, MAC address. You can just, so you got two cards, and so they've got two MAC addresses assigned to them. You use one of those addresses, assign it to both of the cards, and then you use the other one in your kernel. So you don't have to worry about all the MAC addresses. Okay, but that's not really the heart of this solution. There's lots of different approaches to that MAC address problem. There's probably a lot that are a lot better than that. The heart of it is the way the JavaScript works. So we've got all these packets coming in, all the machines getting the packets. We don't want them all to send it on to the real server. That might work. But we don't want the real servers to then send it all back and then, you know, have multiple packets going back to the client, and the client will get very confused and basically close the connection. So we need some way of mediating the traffic. So we do this using filtering, and when you say filtering, we've talked about Linux, it's obviously a net filter problem. Net filter has a bunch of static filters you can set up, but a lot of people use them for various things, including me. But they're usually static. They don't, you set them up and they don't change until you log in and change them again on the command line. They don't adapt when machines come and go. They don't do anything. There's usually a first file or rules or something like this. You don't want them to adapt. But of course, NetFilter is just a lump of code, so it can do anything. And so, what we've done is written a NetFilter module, which again talks to the user space daemon. And the user space daemon basically have a bunch of them running on their different Linux directories, and they decide who's going to get what before the connections arrive, and NetFilter does it for them. So this looks a bit like this. We use Heartbeat. It's another project I'm involved in, a Linux HA project. It talks over using its own IPC mechanism, which has changed during the course of this project. And I wrote this little daemon called Saru. It's just called Saru. Saru means monkey in Japanese. And this project is an ultra monkey project. And it was cool because I instantly had Kanji for my project. So that talks down to the IPT Saru, which is a NetFilter module. Obviously that interacts with NetFilter, and you configure this using IP tables in the normal manner, like you would any other IP tables module. So the reason I used Heartbeat here is because basically this provides me with a very easy way for these Saru daemons on all the different machines to communicate with each other and get notification when the other machines fail or whatever. Heartbeat itself doesn't support the idea of having more than two machines or more specifically, its resource manager doesn't support that idea. So we just run Heartbeat with no resources at all. It's not managing anything. All it's doing is talking to each other and communicating with this arrow daemon. The only real drawback with that is if you actually wanted to use Heartbeat for something else at the same time, that would just basically involve modifying Heartbeat so it could cope with the idea of different classes. So Sarrow keeps these lists basically in its memory of which of its other nodes are online, and when a new one appears it goes, oh well, I have that to the list. They're doing a little bit of an election to decide who's going to be the master. Now that's just so one machine can make decisions. It's like a bit of a dictator. Let's say, right, you will have these connections, you will have these ones, and I'll have these ones. Saves more having to elect and come to consensus on every single decision. Of course, if the node that the master is running on fails, they just have to quickly have another election and elect a new one. There's no reason so I got to implement my own election protocol, which is fun. So then we divide the available space of incoming connections into blocks. So any solution has a space of solutions. And in IP connections, there's a lot of ways to do this. Obvious way is something based on the port number or the IP address number. That's what I've done. It's only an example. There's lots of better ways to do it. But the point is that decision is made before the packets arrive. It's not like the new connection comes in and then one runs around and goes, oh, who will have this? It already knows. So we're not incurring any extra latency to that. And of course, as machines come and go from the cluster, because the more machines you have, the more things fail, they're really allocating the best spread around. Okay, so the idea of blocking was, you don't really want to sort of say, okay, you take the lower half of this space and I'll take the upper half, because usually the connections aren't going to be distributed evenly. If you think about IP addresses, obviously you're not going to get even distribution from all the different IP blocks that exist. So you want to kind of do some sort of interleaving scheme where it's like, you have the first 10, I'll have the second 10, you have the second, and then it's 10 after that, and so on. So for blocks, it's pretty easy because the space is pretty small. The 512 is a limitation of where Heartbeat IPC works, is basically as much information as it starts with the packet. The chief author of Heartbeat and I have a ongoing disagreement about that, but I'm not going to win, so it doesn't matter. So we have 32 ports per block. So this also means that, like, if a bunch of connections come in from the same host, port numbers tend to be consecutive, so it's going to be sort of like end up on the same machine, although it's not really important. And for IP addresses, I did some crazy stuff with monitors because it's having a good day. That's not important. The important thing is the dividing the address space. Okay, so when a connection's receivable, that little Netfilter module does is looks up the block. It keeps a bitmap of which blocks it belongs to, because there's only 512 of them. Yeah, something like that. And just does a quick lookup, and if it's in its bitmap, it accepts it. If it doesn't, it just drops it. Obviously, it's not going to reject the packet, send back ITMP or unreachable. It just throws it away. And that, of course, means that if the cluster's in sort of a bit of a translation state, sometimes for a short time, some blocks aren't going to be accepted anywhere. Like, for instance, the machine's just crashed and hasn't been accepted yet. Then the other machines aren't going to reject that packet. They'll just say, oh, I don't know anything about it. But then, and then the client will hopefully be resending the packet every now and again. And eventually, oh, no, that's fine. serve. Actually, I don't have time at all. Not too quickly. Anyway, it's designed to run on Linux directors. Oh, it's designed to run on Linux, but it's designed to run on Linux directors running LBS. Can be used for other things. In fact, I kind of got this idea from a guy in Netherlands called Bert Humberg, and he was using it because he wanted it to run DNS, especially DNS servers. Of course, it doesn't solve the problem of I have an Apache server and I'm halfway through sucking a file off it and have this green dog that's cold. And the other Apache server is sitting next to it. I can get the packets over there. That connection doesn't exist on that machine. This does not address that problem. That's a much more difficult problem I'll have to. Okay, so in conclusion, I've got a bit of a demo. LBS is very fast. We can use it to load balance internet services. Using active standby, using active standby is a good way of preventing connections. It's a good way of ensuring that the server survives a single failure on the Linux directory. You don't want to have a single point of failure. But by using active connection tracking, you can enhance that behavior, and we can both scale the Linux directories horizontally and also ensure that long-running connections survive any failures that occur. And of course, active, the way the blocks are being reallocated all the time, you need connection synchronization for that to work, of course. So I have a short demo of the connection synchronization code. What I was hoping to do, doing anything. So sad. That really was not supposed to be correct. So this is my test cluster in my lab in Tokyo, and so I use VMware because that's a really cool way to get lots of machines for not much money, and not much space, so I don't mind it. So over here I have two real servers that is running Apache, and they're on Red Hat 7.2 or something like this. It's called V1 and V2. We won't look at for a minute because we're not very busy. And over here I have two Linux directors, which may or may not be named after previous bosses I've had. This one's Wally and this one's Brian. So what I was hoping to do, the way I like to test this, is basically I sit down my desktop with my phones on and I stream music across myself, and when the music stops I'm not a mistake. And I got a really good incentive because I kind of like my music, that's why I have it, so when it stops I want to listen to the rest of it, so I gotta fix it. So unfortunately my firewall is I was working beautifully yesterday, but he decided that he didn't want me to do, because we don't have direct access to these machines, I have to do SSH port forwarding crap, and he didn't want that. But I can SSH straight into these machines, and so load balance SSH just like we can load balance anything else. So what I can do is I'll SSH to the virtual server, and you'll see I end up on either B1 or B2, it's not important which one. And they're going to run a process. For the connection synchronization to work, there needs to be packets flowing. Nothing's happening, it kind of assumes that no And that's okay, because usually we don't load balance things like SSH. We load balance things like HTTP, where people just log in and get the file as fast as they can and get out. Or even streaming services, which are usually a bit slower. That's why it's nice to test with the connection to last a lot of time. But even there, you've still always got bits going across the wire. So I'm going to run a process that will just cause things to happen, like find over and over again. And hopefully, then I'll crash the file of these things. And hopefully, you can see that it keeps going. But actually, before I do that, I'll work out which one is active. So this is not using an active configuration. I do have a firmware for that, but it's really lame. So it's kind of hard to demonstrate it. So. Yeah. So it's a net fails. Usually I would do this locally, but it's just easier. But, alright, I'm gonna go into the SSH because that's a bit easier. Okay. So, I've got my little script that goes through the file. BS, we all know what BS stands for. That's like really, really interesting. Okay, cool. Do you ever notice how you can't type when everyone is watching? Okay, here we are. I'm Wally. So this is one of those virtual machines that I showed you. We can see that it only has one IP address on the Ethernet device, so that means it must not be active. So the other one. Okay, we can see this has two addresses. The 201 address at the bottom, that's the virtual IP address. That's a private address. But in the real world, that would be the address that we're advertising as the address that people connect into. So that's Brian, as you can see. What I'm going to do is I'll log in to the very imaginative game. VS0 stands for Virtual Serial Server Number 0. Hopefully, yes. And you see, so this is a load balanced SSH connection. You see it decided to send it to B2. If I log out and log back in, it'll probably go back to B1 because it's doing round robin and I'm the only person using it. So just switch back on the forum. Well, I hope I'm here. Use of the ES command. Okay, so we can see lots of ESs. It's not really very exciting, is it? I want something that's going to go forever. Space I. Just like that. Oh, cool. Excellent. Thank you very much. Hopefully that will be good. Okay, so by now that connection will have been synchronized. I hope. So, these connections won't show up using NetStat because it's just routing them, but there is a way to show them. pretty lazy idea right there. I put my all my other changes into DNS so I could access them. I don't know why I didn't think of it in a long time ago. You know, I used to admin DNS servers. It's not like I don't know how to use it. So IPvS ADM minus L minus N minus C, which shows the connections it's handling. And there are two, so there was one from Wolf before and there's one from now. Actually what I can do is I can show you on the other machine that that connection will show up there too because it's being synchronized. So we can see that we need to have a bigger screen. We can see in the background we've got that process just ticking over. That's just to keep the connection doing something. We see we have our two load balancers, Wally and Brian. Okay, so Brian is the active load balancer. He's up the top here, and he has one active connection. He had another one that was inactive a moment ago, but that's timed out. And now the bottom, we have Wally, who has the same connection. You can see that the virtue of the destination and the source is the same. Ah, well spotted. Basically, the expiry time is completely irrelevant. Because here it's important. This is active at expiry time that affects the connection. Here, this is really just a placeholder. As soon as a packet hits it, it'll go into the code that updates the expiry time correctly, and those you'll see signs seem more like what you're seeing up the top. Right, it doesn't matter. And as long as it keeps being refreshed before that time, it's really quite irrelevant. Also, the state is not synchronized correctly. Again, it's not critical. I tried to think of, like, this can basically go into a situation where it's closed, and it doesn't tell it that this over here that it's closed. But then that would have been forwarded to the real server anyway, so how are you going to do anything with that anyway? Anyway, that's for it. Expiry time is very important. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to crash Brian, the active machine. Make sure that this is still synchronized. Okay. I can open it in production. Okay, so this is Brian here. So I'm going to just turn it off, basically. Like so. And what you're going to see is this should stop. Stopping because it's got the heartbeat going and it takes a little while to detect the failure. If I'd shut it down cleanly, it wouldn't have been a pause because the heartbeat process on the machine that was going down would have actually said, hey, I'm leaving, do something, and my code would have gone, oh, yes, I know what to do, I'll take all your resources. And so, there we are. I was going to show the streaming of the music, but it's, you know, you can imagine what that would sound like. It would sound like a song that's going and then it stops and then it keeps going. And of course, if you tune the buffer up, you don't hear a pause, right? The delay is for a few seconds. You can easily have a buffer that will take you through that. The way I actually demonstrated this to my client, which was, they were very pleased with this, was I got a DVD of the Matrix. And you can stream DVDs, if you didn't realize that, because it's just done. And I just streamed the Matrix across one from one side of the office, and I just hit the buttons, and you'd see Trinity jumping across the box, and then she'd stop, and then she'd keep going. And everyone was very pleased with that, including Nick. So anyway, that's all I have to say today. I have finished about on time, so any questions, please ask, or please come pester me. Yes and no. As a developer, it's in my best interest not to know how my competitors implement their code. But I have done, looking at sales documentation and comparing features. The two main competitors are the Foundry and the M5. I think I have the Foundry is a bit better these days. They've got some very nice features. You've got to be careful the way they do their feature list. A lot of it's just fluff. Other than the layer 7 stuff, then look at things like SSL and things like this, there's not much that they do that couldn't easily be done in LVS. Same for F5. Patent stuff aside, most of that can be done very easily. We run /.jp, and we released a recent launch manager using F5 for LVS, and that worked pretty well. And we do pretty well with our clients. We basically implement mail servers for people amongst other things, and they'll be like, yeah, we're going to spend $100,000 on F5 here, and we're like, well, how about we customize LVS to make it do exactly what you want, and you can keep three-quarters of the money and give the rest to us. And so it's a situation where I have to hack some script for a week, and that company gets $25,000 or something stupid for it. So that's how I get to have a job. It's nice. Next. Run it over a different interface. Yeah, because you can get, it's pretty hard for them to get a packet to go in ETH1 if that's plugged out the back. If you're using the NAT module, yes, because you are on port. If you're using otherwise, no, it needs 128 bytes per connection, which is not much. Not really. No, everything's stored in a hash. You can, by default, there's, I think, 4,000 hash buckets, but that's tunable. And a hash bucket can have multiple entries. No, there's no limitation in terms of that. 128 bytes, how many questions? Connections, if you've got a machine with, say, 256 meg of RAM, 1.5 gig of RAM, it's heat, Right. I don't actually run production systems, but I do know people do, and I know that that hasn't been a problem. Kind of, if you talk to Harold, who's the architect, who's like the best building maintainer, he doesn't like what we've done. He doesn't like it because he says it's not accurate, things will go missing, and that is true. He wants to make something that's rock solid, you'll never ever drop anything ever. I don't agree with him, I think he could do it. And I'm not the only person that doesn't agree with him. So you've got your connection tracking code that will be by the way, LVS doesn't work very well with connection tracking because it does its own. There are patches to make that work. So if you want to do a state-based firewall on LVS, not really the best thing, but it can be made to work. Sure. If you go to ultramonkey.org, I have a list of papers up there. Also my personal website, which is linux.mock.org. linuxvirtualserver.org is a list of papers as well. There's quite a lot of information out there. Yes. No, but you could, it would be a trivial challenge. The reason it used multicast is so you can scale it up easily, but if you really wanted to use unicast, that would be a trivial challenge. Yeah, I'm not sure why you wouldn't want to use multicast, but because it's on the left, usually the reason you don't want to use multicast is because it's not routed by most people, but you don't want to route it anyway. And it's a bit nicer than the broadcast because not everybody gets it. Yeah. For this. Okay, so all the code I've talked about today is new stuff that I've developed, which is not in. You have to go to the ultimate.org to get it. What is in 2.4 is. In 2.4 there's a version of synchronization code which is pretty limited, but you can patch it. In 2.6 there's a better version, so you can run the master and slave at the same time. I think it works, so I haven't really used 2.6 for that much. But basically, aside from the work that I've done, the latest version of the code is in the main kernel. Actually, even later than what's on the website, so I don't know. Okay, any more questions, maybe just catch me later in the week or send me an email. I'm pretty easy to find. You just put Horms into any search engine and don't go to the embarrassing photos link. The other one. Thank you very much.